This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about ongoing protests of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
The European white colonial powers that took over this continent 400 years ago initiated the devastation of Native American culture, and they're continuing it to this day. Listen to what's going on in North Dakota.
We talk about an innovative film project launched in the late 1960s at Otisville Training School.
This was a time when children were actually treated gently and intelligently as compared to today.
And we talk about the travesty that is the United States criminal justice system as it deals with children.
Locking children up has been a 100% failure. Bernardine Dorn will describe what has resulted.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The Dakota Access Pipeline seeks to build its pipeline across the Missouri River, North Dakota. If allowed, the 30-inch, 1,172-mile pipeline would carry more than 500,000 barrels of crude oil a day from the Bakken Shale in western North Dakota to the Midwest. A breach in the integrity of that pipeline would likely contaminate the Missouri River, a source of water for at least 20 million people. The pipeline itself threatens the water in traditional lands of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. It was redirected toward the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe so it would not go through the white, non-native lands and communities. In April of this year, researchers at the University of Michigan found that the Bakken oil field is emitting about 2% of the world's methane, approximately 250,000 tons per year into the air, directly affecting air quality across North America. These emissions, combined with combustion of Bakken oil, are major contributors to the global climate crisis that threatens the well-being of our environment, future generations, and planet Earth. The resistance started with 35 people. There are now more than 2,000 people and Native American representatives from over 100 Native nations gathering in North Dakota to block the Dakota Access Pipeline. Our guest today is attorney Jeff Haas. He is one of the National Lawyers Guild members representing the Camp of the Sacred Stones in North Dakota, who are seeking to block construction of the pipeline. Jeff was a founding partner of the People's Law Office in Chicago and victoriously represented the family of Fred Hampton, chairman of the Chicago Black Panther Party, and proved that Hampton was assassinated by the FBI and Chicago Police Department. He's author of the book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton. Attorney Jeff Haas, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Jeff, how did you get involved in representing members of the Camp of the Sacred Stones in North Dakota? And what does the camp stand for?
The camp is this amazing gathering that varies from 3,000 to 5,000 people, over 100 nations. It was set up originally by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. And it's an encampment here to make a statement that they will not let the pipeline go through native land, sacred sites, and threatening their water supply. And so the encampment is right near where the pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline, wants to build under the Missouri River, right above where they get their drinking water from. So the encampment itself is a very strong statement. And they've also taken various actions to stop the actual construction of the pipeline. I guess I got involved both from a supporting indigenous rights perspective and environmental perspective. This pipeline could be a disaster, bringing 500,000 gallons of oil, barrels a day of oil from the Bakken oil fields to the Midwest. That's oil that should stay in the ground. And it goes through across 200 rivers and tributaries, the potential for leaks. It's more than a potential, it's a likelihood. The Missouri River is drinking water to 20 million people, and it goes under the Missouri River at least two places. So this, from an environmental, from a water, from a sacred site, from a sovereignty position, all of these issues, it seems to me, have come together, and the Native Americans are leading this struggle.
Now, we recently heard about the confrontation between camp protesters and security guards for the pipeline. Were you on site, and can you tell us what happened?
I was. What we thought was sort of a daily ritual march to the pad where they intend to cross the Missouri. There had been no construction there for a while, so we marched from the camp up there maybe a mile and a half. And literally, as Dennis Banks was speaking, he said, well, it's time to go back to the camp. And then somebody said, no, there's construction going on up ahead. And so we went 200 yards up the road, and there were six huge earth-moving equipment, bulldozers, moving the ground, leveling these rolling hills on the other side of a fence. And there were 8 or 10 security guards, private security guards, protecting them. The people started shouting, and then the people decided to walk through the fence and confront the construction workers and these earth-moving equipments and backed them up and actually drove them out of the field. But in response, these security guards pulled these dogs, the attack dogs, out of their trucks, started macing people, and let a couple of dogs loose, and we had about 8 or 10 dog bites. So I felt a little bit like I was in Birmingham or maybe on the West Bank with the bulldozers. But eventually it was a big up for the tribe because they left. They left their equipment, they left their trucks and fled. So it was a little bit like the Battle of Bull Run, too, in miniature. And there were no arrests made. So it was a very strident action, but of course this thing with the dogs was very, very scary, and the fact that they would use dogs, and these were basically people who were not trying to be violent, they were not trying to hurt the workers. It was a direct, nonviolent, direct action kind of situation. To be there, it was very dramatic, and to see the bravery and the strength and the determination of these people to not let this pipeline go through their land. Ironically, the next day we learned that in D.C., in the legal case, an expert had just said that exact area was home to about several burial sites and sacred sites for the Native Americans. And they had gone in and said, Judge, you got to stop this construction. And the next morning, before the judge even ruled, they're out there with bulldozers. And then when he goes and assesses it, he says, yes, you've destroyed most of what I just uncovered. And this is just totally outrageous. And so yesterday in the case in D.C., which is an action by the tribe against the Army Corps of Engineers, they went in and sought an injunction against further construction. And the judge came out with a very strange ruling. He ruled that they couldn't do construction on the east side of this fence, this road, and the Missouri, but they could on the west side. And the west side is where all the action is occurring, where the pipeline is actually being constructed at this time. So the court kind of said, well, our jurisdiction is limited to where the Army Corps of Engineers has jurisdiction, which is under the Missouri and a few miles on each side. And that's really troublesome because the issue in D.C. is this granting the permit for the whole pipeline. And one of the arguments is you have to look at all the effects of it, not just an individual effect in a locale. And the signal by the judge yesterday was he might not do that. So I think we were pretty optimistic because the Army Corps of Engineers had done the most superficial study of sacred sites and had not consulted the tribe, which they're bound to do under law. And actually said to the pipeline, will you tell us if you're destroying sacred sites? And, of course, they said, oh, no, they're not here. So we're waiting on a decision on that injunction in D.C. to see if the pipeline would be stopped. But after the ruling yesterday, the idea that their whole permit would be disallowed is looking less likely.
What do you think the next steps are?
Well, the next steps are obviously to try to get the permit withdrawn. I think it's to put pressure, frankly, on the president and executive agencies who could pull the plug on this, just like they did the KXL pipeline. And then there's this slap suit in Bismarck.
Explain to our listeners what a slap suit is, please.
A slap suit is an attempt to prevent people from protesting an activity that's going on. In this case, there have been people arrested here trying to stop the building of the pipeline. So the DAPL, Dakota Access Pipeline LLC, has filed a suit against the tribal leaders and has a TRO against them from interfering with the building of the pipeline. And what that means is if they were to do what the court decides is interfere, not only are they facing criminal charges, but possibly contempt of court charges. So as Gill lawyers, we sought to intervene yesterday, Bruce Ellison and I, and I think we will be in the case. There are other lawyers also. But that's going to be fought out up here in North Dakota, which is not friendly territory to people who are against oil and gas development. And one of the comments of the judge was, I'm concerned about how much money this pipeline is putting in and how much they're spending to get it done. So by implication, anything that interferes with that is a problem for me.
Jeff, can you briefly address what domestic or international laws or treaties are being broken by the construction of the pipeline?
Yeah, I think, and the tribe has gone to the UN Rapporteur on water and on indigenous rights. Basically, the land that, to begin with, the land for this pipeline is on treaty, what they call treaty land, which is land that was ceded to the Sioux in 1871, but the U.S. stole it back illegally. So they have a claim there. The U.S. just did not ignore the treaty. But this is sacred land to them, and they have sacred sites. And even according to both domestic and international law, before they destroy those, they have to consult with the Native Americans, with the indigenous people. And there was no consultation done. So that's one of the main both domestic issues and international issues, is you can't destroy sacred lands and Native historic sites. At least you have to consult with them on what they are and how to preserve them. In this case, when they learned where they were, they actually came out and bulldozed those sites the next day.
Yeah, unbelievable. So what kind of support is coming in from your vantage point? Do you see that support coming in from across the country?
I do. In some instances, you have Jill Stein was here yesterday, and people were tagging equipment with no DAPL, and water is life. And Jill Stein came out to the site and put, I approve this message, Jill Stein. And the sheriff said he's going to arrest her because they stopped the machinery and now it's been tagged. And I think Bernie Sanders came out with a statement today. Environmental groups, some have been slow to come on. I know 350 just said they support it. Individually, just people, indigenous people, environmental people are showing up at camp. And it's still the rules it's dominated by Native peoples, and it's really beautiful to see the way they've set up this camp. They have six kitchens here. They have a medical tent. They have security. People are here for the long run. I don't think they're going to leave this camp. The camp itself is on land of the Army Corps of Engineers, so technically they're trespassing. So at any moment, things could get particularly violent or tumultuous here because of the situation.
Jeff, in addition to the legal problems, what's the track record of Dakota Access Pipeline?
And its parent company.
And its parent company.
Yeah, the Energy Transfer Partners, that Texas outfit.
Energy Transfer Partners is a big player in the pipeline business, and they have been responsible for numerous spills and have been the subject of lawsuits, injunctions, and spills on other pipelines. Like I said, it's a sure thing that if they build a pipeline of this length through this many terrain across rivers and so forth, there will be leaks. And there will be leaks that could be tremendously damaging to the water supply. So this is a company that's all out for getting as much done as possible. And I think the fact that they hired these security guards with dogs to defend their bulldozing on a Saturday morning right after they'd learned that these were sacred sites shows their determination to go ahead. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people up here in North Dakota that support that, including the governor. So they have a history of they want to get this oil. They're somewhat threatened, the Bakken oil fields. If there's no way to get their oil out, their boom and bust economy in North Dakota will get more busted than it has been in some places. So it's sort of a Hail Mary for them in some ways, On the other hand, the danger of the pipeline is also that there are pipelines going north from the Bakken oil fields into Canada, and this pipeline could also ultimately be a way for the tar sands oil to get south.
There are several billion reasons for the bad guys to push this. That's how much they're investing in this pipeline, so it's understandable.
$3.8 billion is what they put the cost at.
Yeah. What do you suggest that our listeners who support the camp and the resistance, what can they do?
Well, the one thing they can do is, as I said, these people are in camp for the long run. And I think that giving support to them through GoFundMe at Sacred Stone Camp is really an important thing to do. And also, if there are lawyers that want to come up here, there's a lawyer named Robin Martinez who is sort of vetting people. If lawyers have criminal defense skills or environmental skills and want to come up here, they'd be welcome. And they can reach Robin. It's robin.martinez@martinezlaw.net. Or they could go to the National Lawyers Guild Mass Defense Office. King Downing could route them to Robin. People want to come out here, I guarantee you they will be inspired. People want to come to camp and lend their services, whether it's wood chopping or cooking, or they will have starting a school here and you're a teacher. They can use their support. I think the motto is just make sure you leave the camps as strong or stronger than when you came. But people are welcome.
Jeff Haas, do you have any last thoughts? I know that you got to get back to your legal business, but before you go, do you have any last thoughts you want to share with us?
I just think it's really inspiring to see so many people have put their lives out here, have given up their normal lives, their jobs, their whatever, and come here and said, we're going to take a position, we're going to make a stand. And I think the response nationally and around the world has been supportive and acknowledging that. And I don't know what's ahead. There's probably going to be many more confrontations with the police, and there's a determination here of the people to not let this pipeline happen. So I think there's going to be more conflict. I hope there's more support. I hope there's enough pressure nationally to get the president and the executive to stop this pipeline.
Jeff, thank you once again for being really on the front lines of people's fighting for justice.
Well, it's really an honor to be here.
Jeff, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. We'd like to get back to you next week and get more information from the front lines, but go ahead and cause some trouble.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
I appreciate it, and appreciate you getting the word out to so many folks.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Women, we linked arms and we went up to the front line and we started pushing through, and we weren't like literally pushing, we were just walking, and this guy comes, he's a private contractor security, and he started spraying her, and then he started spraying right along everyone who was linked up.
Long before the state correctional facility Otisville was established in Mount Hope, New York, it was a tuberculosis sanitarium, a training school for boys, and even a drug abuse treatment center. After the TB hospital closed in 1955, the State Division for Youth purchased the sprawling property and renamed it the New York State Otisville Training School. It housed boys aged 14 to 17 from across the state for periods of up to 18 months and functioned as a boys' training school. Many were persons in need of supervision who'd had fights with their parents or been truants from school. Others were there for drugs, robbery, and even homicide. Before the training school closed its doors in 1972, a special 16mm film program launched in the late 60s tapped the creativity of the boys there. Joining us to talk about this program, and hoping to reconnect with any listeners who may have attended the film project, is media activist Dee Dee Halleck. Dee Dee is co-founder of Paper Tiger Television and the Deep Dish Satellite Network, the very first grassroots community television network in the country. She's also Professor Emerita in the Department of Communication at the University of California at San Diego. Welcome, Dee Dee, to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be here.
How did you first get involved in teaching at Otisville Training School?
Well, I had taught at Henry Street Settlement, and I had founded a film club there in the 60s. And I moved upstate because I had three young children, and we wanted to get out of the city. And so I moved upstate, but I didn't have a job. And I looked around for the kind of job that I had done before. So I began teaching arts and crafts at Otisville, which in the upstate communities, that's one of the options there are, is working at a prison or in this case, a youth facility.
And at the time, this was the late 60s, what kind of bureaucracy, if any, did you encounter dealing with the administration there?
Interesting enough, actually the director at the time was a guy named Benjamin Hill, who was he used to walk around with a pith helmet. And he had the boys dress in white coats and serve cocktails at his house, which was this mansion that was part of the property. So he was had this kind of colonial attitude, but he really let me. I taught arts and crafts, and the kids did terrific things. So there was a lot of confidence in my work, so I suggested applying for a Title I, I forget whether it was one, two, or three title, that there was money at that time by the late 60s to do kind of alternative education. And so we got $10,000 the first year, which basically allowed us to buy a Bolex camera and some rewinds and a little viewer to make film, which I had done at Henry Street. So I also had set up a film program there. So we were off and running. By that time, it took a while to have that money come through. So meanwhile, I was teaching arts and crafts, and I was able to set up a kind of club room. We used to call it the club, rather than a classroom. So, and it was part of what was called the vocational part. They would have half of the students went to academic programs, and then then half of their time they would go to vocational. So I had vocational students, but I was able to get them all day because we did do things like write scripts, and so it was like it was very unusual, actually, that I was given so much freedom, and people got very interested in the program, and by the time we had like art shows in the community, and by the time we had finished films, the community, different high schools and churches wanted us to come and show the films there. So
I read on your website that there was a counterpart girls program, or they took an interest in the boys program.
Well, what happened was I would take the guys off campus. We had this, we would take the state car, and the state insignia meant that they were prisoners. As soon as we came, like, within, like, half a mile of the institution, they would jump out, and they had this cardboard sign that they had designed that said Art Film Club, and they would put that with gaffer tape on the side of the car to cover it up the state insignia. So we would cruise into Middletown, which was the closest kind of urban center. And it was like honey for bees. All of a sudden, all these girls would appear. And these guys were really cool. They were able to wear their street clothes, which were not the clothes that were given them for their dorm, but they were able, if they went off campus, they were allowed to wear their really cool early 70s pants.
Marlon Brando type.
And shirts. No, we're talking about the Temptations, like some kind of satin shirts with ruffles. So they would cruise through Middletown, and they met lots of girls. Now the girls then asked me, "Can't we make films also? We have a film to tell our story." And so I applied to the New York State Council on the Arts, and I got funding to set up a film club in Middletown. It was at the Martin Luther King Jr. Center, which was at the AME Zion Church. So,
wow. And what kind of projects did the boys work on? We saw one where he was in a laboratory mixing up a potent mix that then turned him into various animals. How creative they were.
Yeah, well, that was Kenneth Brown, and he really wanted to take a science class, but he was not allowed to because his grades weren't up to what they required for the science class. So he made up this script, and that allowed him to get into the science. And the science teacher actually really supported us and helped him set up this elaborate kind of Bunsen burner and little glass tubing and stuff. And so it was sort of like a Jekyll and Hyde he turns into. But then he ended up turning into a frog and hopping away. So
looking for a princess.
Yes.
I saw the movie this morning, and it's really quite clever. We'll link to it at lawanddisorder.org. Given how repressive things are in this carceral state of America in 2016, it's really wonderful to hear about how things used to be, and gives us hope for how things might be again. What do you think about how one would be able to teach a class like this now?
I think in this day and age, they'd be dressed in orange jumpsuits. They wouldn't be allowed off campus. They might even be shackled when they move from room to room. I mean, I kept a diary, and I was just reading it today on the way to come here. And I said, one of the kids, he was bored, and I said, well, go up to the dorm and get your guitar. The notion that an imprisoned young person could actually walk around this very open campus, there were no fences. There was no, he could actually go up and go get his guitar. I had to call ahead and say he was coming, but he was able just to walk out, and he comes back with a guitar and bangs away. But it was really an unusual experiment in doing a creative, really kind of unusually. A lot of the films are about drugs, and that we were able to actually tackle difficult questions. But it was also an unusual time. I mean, a lot of the kids were 5 percenters. They were Muslim kids, and Clarence the 13X, who had founded the cult of the 5 percenters, he really encouraged kids to be themselves, have a lot of confidence in themselves, and he had really focused on these youth institutions, actually. And he was later killed. Probably people feel that one of the reasons he was killed was by drug dealers, because he encouraged kids to get off drugs. He wasn't against marijuana, but he went on a kind of anti-heroin campaign. It's similar to Malcolm X is what I hear. And he would stand on street corners, and these kids, even if they if they hadn't met him by this time, he was dead. But they studied their lessons. They were into learning about Africa, learning about the history of Muslim, of Islamic religion, etc. And it was a time of kind of of opening up, of kind of identity. People that I think really helped in terms of the administration wanted to quash that. And so they saw my program as this kind of creative outlet that would keep them maybe out of trouble, but they and away from this kind of Muslim attention. So,
Didi, have you remained in touch with any of the students?
That is what's really sad, is that I have one of the girls is Flora Hunter, who's now Flora Hunter Khan. And she made a beautiful film, Hey There, Lonely Girl. And I have been in touch with her, and she's now a great-grandmother. that's the age of these kids now. They're in their 60s. I desperately want to try to get in touch with them. And so if anybody hears this radio and was at Otisville and would know any of these young people, who are now in great-grandparents or grandparents, please go to the website, which is otisvillefilmclub.blogspot.com. There's a blog that has a lot of the films and a list of all the young men who worked with me, and hopefully that we can get in touch with them. Unfortunately, when they were in Five Percenters, a lot of them changed their names. So that's the institution always kept their birth names, but they probably are known by other names now.
And complicating this is the fact that that facility closed down in the early 70s.
It didn't close. It became a federal pen. And I actually visited there when a lot of the Haitians were kept there when they would, there was a big migration of Haitians, and they sent them up to Otisville. And I went there as I was a co-producer of a film called Haiti, Bitter Cane, and we interviewed two of the Haitian refugees who were incarcerated, much like the way that ICE is doing now. They were just refugees, and they were socked right into prison.
Didi, what was the atmosphere of their work?
To me, that was the most important thing. It was not even like making films. It was having a place where they could read, they could sit and listen to music, they could watch television. It was like a home for them. And in fact, we were able to decorate this room that we reused them ourselves. And the first thing they did, we got some paint, and they wanted to paint it black. And the first thing they painted was the windows. And I said, why are you painting the windows black? And they said, we don't want to see the mountains and the hills, because when we're in this room, we're in the city. And it feels like home. And so even though the outside was this gorgeous, and the time they were painting, it was this beautiful fall weather, and there was all these red maple trees and stuff, they didn't want to see any of that. They wanted a place where they could feel at home. And that's what I tried to do, was make an atmosphere where they could learn. And one of the things we had was a map of Brooklyn on the wall. I got a huge map of Brooklyn, and they would look and try to find their familiar streets and see where their girlfriend lived or whatever. So this was way before the days of the internet. So of course there was no internet at that time. But we tried to be as open and have a space where people could really flourish. And they did.
We've been talking with Didi Halleck, who one of our friends, Karen Renucci, refers to as the mother of community video. But this was before community video. These are movies that she worked with young people making. Didi, before we let you go, do you have any last thoughts?
Well, I'd like to try to connect with these kids and to have them speak. I did connect with Flora Hunter, who was one of the girls from Middletown, And I asked her how it changed, and she said in so many ways she couldn't even describe. But she said it didn't seem to me that her life was all that different. But she said that it was very different because she's married to a Pakistani man. And she said, Dee Dee, I would never have married a Pakistani man before I took your class. And she said, he is such a good man. And my son is so, I'm so proud of him. And she said, I would never have opened myself up to appreciate who he was if I hadn't taken your class. So she didn't become a filmmaker, but she did have a really good life and has wonderful kids, all of whom have gone to college. Her grandkids have gone to college, and she's an amazing woman.
Dee Dee, one more time for listeners who might have known someone who took the class, how did they contact you?
They should go to the website, www.otisvillefilmclub.blogspot.com. It's a blog, and there's a lot of the films that are there. So
we'll link to it on lawanddisorder.org.
Dee Dee Halleck, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Wonderful project, Dee Dee.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
A story I want to tell somebody, in my life I've seen a lot of things go down. I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying
juveniles in the United States criminal justice system are not afforded the same protections as adults. They are often not allowed to have a lawyer when they are arrested or interrogated, and often see a lawyer only for the first time at their trial. When under interrogation, the police use deceptive methods to secure confessions, sometimes false ones. Comparatively, the protections afforded juveniles in Europe are more fair. They include the provision of an attorney when the child is first taken into custody, as well as later, through trial and revocation of parole or probation. We know from medical science and adolescent behavior development that children's brains are not the same as adults. The reasoning and decision-making abilities of a child are different. Moreover, children of color are not treated the same as white children in the United States of America. We talk more about children within the criminal justice system with retired Professor Bernardine Dorn. She was the founder and former director of the Children and Family Justice Center and the Blum Legal Clinic at Northwestern University Law School. In the 60s, Bernardine Dorn was the student organizer of the National Lawyers Guild and has remained a leading figure in the National Lawyers Guild. Bernardine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on it again. I love your show, and it's terrific to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Tell us, how did you get involved in juvenile justice?
That requires me thinking quickly here. It was fortuitous, I have to say. I think that I was at a loss about what to do. I'd been underground for 11 years, as part of the Weather Underground. I was back in public life. I had gone to law school years before, decades before. I had three sons. I had close comrades and family members in prison, some of them for life. And our youngest son, Cheza's parents were in jail for life, so we were regularly getting phone calls and visiting prisons. And I was watching, this happened to be in the late 80s, so it was the beginning, really, of the era of mass incarceration of children, of juveniles, of adolescents, and the super predator phenomenon. And so I think the combination of all of those matters led me to, when I was starting a children's rights center, to focus on as we say, children in conflict with the law, or really the law in conflict with children, particularly in the United States, black children and Latino children and Native children.
There was a significant Supreme Court case back in 1967 called In re Galt, and I wanted to ask you why that was important with respect to the rights of juveniles. Notice of charges against them, right to legal counsel, right to protection against self-incrimination, and so on. Could you speak to us about that? Because that was really, I thought, a significant turning point in juvenile rights.
Yes, it really was the beginning of this era of juvenile rights, and it happened. It was a decision the year that I graduated from law school. Gerald Galt was a young 15-year-old boy in Arizona. He and his friend, perhaps, made a phone call to a neighbor woman that was described by the Supreme Court as lewd and lascivious, the kind of phone call that often teenagers do or did in the, back then. I think comparable things would be Internet things today. Although it would have been a two-month sentence if an adult had been convicted of it. So Gerald Galt ended up being sentenced to 6 to 9 years in prison for an offense, if it were really an offense, that an adult would have had 2 months and a fine. This case, by a series of miracles, got picked up by ACLU lawyers and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court held that he had every basic constitutional right that an adult had, children were constitutional people. That really was the essence of that decision, except for the issue of the right to bail. Children had a right to confront witnesses, to be informed of the charges against them, to have a lawyer represent them, to appeal their sentence, and so on, all the kind of core due process rights that are the province of adults in the system. So it was a landmark case about children's rights, and it really, some people would say, it actually destroyed the benefits of juvenile court, of children having a separate court for children that was more informal, and others would say that that informality really harmed children, depending on who you were in front of, that the paternal notion of, you know, the good, kindly, good, kind and gentle juvenile court judge was not what was happening at all, and it certainly wasn't happening with African-American, Latino, Native children who ended up sentenced to reformatories and horrible prisons for very minor offenses, as, of course, is still true in large sections of the country today. So it was a really important decision. It galvanized a group of people who then became children's lawyers, children's rights lawyers, or youth rights lawyers, and it meant that we had kind of a network and a base for advocacy. When I started this project at Northwestern Law School, it was right at the moment of the super predator, the Central Park jogger case, the kind of massive criminalization of youth that was experienced, in which police and prosecutors and academics and judges participated. At that point, prison population was overwhelmingly defined by race and ethnicity in the United States, and was no longer a majority white prison population. So that's when I came into this field, and the 90s were a terrible period for this in the U.S. But by the end of the 90s, we started to win some victories. That's a whole other story.
Bernadine, you mentioned the term super predator, and what do you mean by that? Was that a term of art?
It was not a term of art. It was a term of hate, really. Was invented by a couple of known academic, respectable criminologists, and it was seized upon to during the Central Park jogger case, which you'll remember occurred in 1989 in New York, in which these five young adolescents were arrested for the brutal assault and rape and attempted murder on a white woman jogger on one fine day in New York. And they were interrogated, they confessed in various ways, They were interrogated over a period of 18 hours. And the term super predator was really coined during that period when the headlines in the Daily News and the Post every day were about rampaging motherless, fatherless, godless teenagers. It was all about animals. It was wolf pack. They were described as a wolf pack, as remorseless, American coded language for black and Latino boys.
Yeah, I remember when Trump put a full-page ad in the papers here in New York calling for the death penalty for these five juveniles.
That's exactly right.
And I remember
He got the death penalty reinstituted in New York.
Exactly.
Even though it was never used.
Mm-hmm. And then Hillary Clinton called them super predators. But I wanted to go back to some of our victories here. Roper versus Simmons, for one. Could you talk about that case, please?
You know, a small group of us, when the beginnings of the movement about wrongful convictions of adults started to happen, when I know it best from Illinois because I was here then and living here and at Northwestern Law School, and my colleague Larry Marshall was one of the leaders of the wrongful conviction movement. And he had a national conference about it in 1998. And I asked him if we could have just a workshop on wrongful convictions of youth. He said, sure. We surprised ourselves by having a huge audience who came to it, by connecting across the country with experts in the area. And there were at that time about 75 or 80 people on death row in the United States who had been convicted for crimes that they had allegedly committed as youth. So it wasn't a huge number, but it happened that the United States was the only country in the world that was legally executing young people. Now, they weren't young by the time they were executed, so I don't want you to have a picture of, you know, a teddy bear and an electric chair. They, by the time the appeals were exhausted and so on, they were in their late 20s or 30s, but nonetheless, they were convicted for crimes that they committed as children. So we took up a campaign to abolish the juvenile death penalty. And it took us 5 years, and the case that finally went to the U.S. Supreme Court was Roper versus Simmons. And a case coming out of, you know, a really terrible murder committed by a 17-year-old white boy, as it turned out. But the Supreme Court ruled in that case the death penalty was unconstitutional. They actually wrote 4 pages in a decision written by Justice Kennedy about how the United States was the only country in the world, that it was a violation of international law and the Convention on the Rights of the Child, even though the United States hadn't ratified it, and that it was basically something that had been rejected by the world's people and by the world's nations as much as, you know, lynching and public guillotine kind of punishments had been rejected. So it was a big victory for us. We had worked to change the law in several states to have enough states, as it turned out, 30 states by the time the court made this decision. So we then went on to the next extreme sentence, which is life without possibility of parole for children that is sentenced to die in prison. That's how we framed the issue, and we started the campaign for the Fair Sentencing Abuse, which is the national network devoted to this issue. We've had now 3 more Supreme Court cases whittling away instead of totally abolishing the sentence of life without possibility of parole. And now every one of those 2,400 people who are serving life sentences are entitled to a hearing to review under new criteria whether they should continue to have that sentence or whether 20 years or 30 years is enough and they pose no public risk. It's been an interesting and challenging time. I think that one could say that the lawyers, Brian Stevenson among them, from Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama, have convinced the court that this was a barbaric and inhuman sentence and had nothing to do with public safety or the role of children in in creating a major risk. It's adults who commit violent crime, of course, and not children.
Bernadine, can you talk briefly about the struggle for children to get early effective right to counsel? How do states differ in that?
You know, I'm so glad you asked about this, because with the Galt decision, the fact that children had a right to lawyers was such a breakthrough and took up the next 40 years of energy and interest among the bar and activists in behalf of children's rights and formerly incarcerated kids and their parents, who have come to form a very big part of this coalition that we work with. But we never really looked at the question until recently about when children have that right to counsel. Is it days later when they first appear in court, sometimes a week or two later? Is it only after they've proved their indigency and get appointed a counsel? It varies enormously from state to state, but it's fair to say that nobody has in the United States yet, although we're getting close to our first couple of states, has a position that children cannot be interrogated by police before having a lawyer, their lawyer, not just a lawyer, their lawyer present during that interrogation. And that is now the law in Europe. In 2008, there were two cases in the European Court of Human Rights that held, yes, indeed, we mean you cannot even interrogate the children short of, you know, the exceptional, mythical terrorist possibility without that child having a lawyer present. And it's transformed the work of policing across Europe and the protections, the special protections that children need. All you have to do is look at a video, for example, of, let's take something a lot of people, millions of people now know, which is the Making a Murderer podcast taking place in a small town in rural Wisconsin, and watch the interrogation of Brian Dassey, 15-year-old disabled youth, and see that basically, police interrogation without hitting anybody or beating anybody can result in a confession, for really from an adult too, but certainly from an adolescent. A false confession with no other evidence. This young man is convicted of murder, rape, and so on. No other forensic evidence, no other reliable evidence, no blood, no semen, no DNA. We now know that those kinds of confessions that police have been trained to elicit are not reliable evidence absent some other kind of forensic evidence.
Bernadine, on a related note, can you talk briefly about what we know from adolescent behavior development and brain science with respect to criminal law as it applies to children?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that, because simultaneously with us preparing for the Roper decision, the death abolition of the juvenile death penalty, and in the next 2 years, there emerged a new science of brain development, the technology to actually look at and scan the frontal lobe and watch its development across all kinds of different young people. And what emerged was a science that said the brain isn't fully developed really until the age of 24 or 25. But certainly during the adolescent years, the parts of the brain that are developed have to do with risk, enjoying risk-taking, acting in groups, unable to foresee the consequences of what you do. Those are the kind of core ideas. And the parts of the frontal lobe development, which allows you to contemplate risk, allows you to get yourself out of a situation where you're with a group of young people, acting foolish, which all of us should remember that happened to everybody under different circumstances, usually without a gun in your hand. Anyway, this brain development came into being, and the Supreme Court and actually courts across the country were able to see it and recognize its legitimacy and add to what we already knew from behavioral development about why adolescents are a unique stage of human development, more susceptible to taking risks and more susceptible to doing dangerous things. Of course, the criminal justice system is overlaid with issues of race and class and, to some extent, gender. And so if you're white and privileged and you have family who will not let you sit overnight in jail, who will have a lawyer on the spot that will stop interrogation of you, who will come up with other remedies other than prison for committing offenses and breaking the law, then you have a cushion and you will be able to recover. But if you're going to the public system and you're poor and you're from certain zip codes and you're a Black or Latino, you will be driven into a system that is likely to lead you into a life of incarceration.
Bernadine, we only have a few minutes remaining. I wanted to mention that in 2013, you wrote that on any given night, about 55,000 children were incarcerated, nearly 90% of those for nonviolent offenses, and 66% youth of color. What structural and legal reforms do you advocate to address these problems?
We know scientifically that incarcerating children, that jailing them, caging them, locking them up in the name of saving them is 100% failure. It's terrible for children at the age in which they're developing and growing. And that includes 16, 17-year-olds. It doesn't matter what the offense is. We know that incarcerating children is absolutely destructive to their future. It will make it harder for them to recover from their offense. It will be harder for them to understand that they are, in some sense, responsible for harm. And it will make it almost impossible for them to continue their education, get a job, have housing, and be eligible for even voting. So it's terrible. It's actually terrible all over the world when this happens. And so we know also that alternatives to incarceration are possible, and alternatives to punishment in the criminal justice system are possible, because kids who have privilege get the benefit of it all the time, and they are able to recover and go ahead and have fruitful and productive lives. So that's what we should do. We should not incarcerate children except as a last resort, ever, not in detention in the front end and not in incarceration in the back end. We should have community-based programs that are supervisory and encourage education and healthy behavior, the arts, sports, everything else that we want for our children. And we should take down and bulldoze the prisons and reformatories and all the horrible names that we put on institutions that cage children.
Absolutely.
And we should do it quickly.
Absolutely.
We spend a tremendous amount of money doing exactly the wrong thing.
What opportunities do you see the Black Lives Matter movement presenting to us now for some sort of serious structural and legal reforms?
I think they've opened up a huge path for us, and it's an opportunity. We don't know how long it will last, but they have shown that the police at the front end of contact with young people are violent, lie about what they've done, and that the prosecutors and judges corroborate those lies on a daily basis. You go into any criminal court or juvenile court in the country and watch police lie on the stand and cover for each other. It's a structural issue. It's not about an individual police officer, but structurally that's their function. And by exposing that, I think they've shown us the possibility that we can actually stop it in these institutions, not take it for granted that this is right, not take it for granted that punishment of kids is the way, but absolute impunity for police and prosecutors is the way to be.
Bernadine, we could go on forever with you, but this has been enlightening, depressing, and instructional.
And hopeful. And hopeful also, Bernadine. Thank you so much, Bernadine Dorn, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Law and Disorder. I love you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.